Thank you very much. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is April 6, 2022. We have five cases on the calendar for today. This is the second of two oral arguments that we have scheduled. This is case number 821-1231, in re the estate of Joan Russell Gregory. Excuse me. And we will be recording the oral arguments here. No other recordings are permitted at this time for this case. We are holding these arguments via zoom.gov. Appreciate your attendance here. We will, if there are any issues, technical issues at all, we will address them if they do come up, and they do come up on occasion. We will otherwise be following all the rules of appellate procedure. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial oral arguments. Counsel for respondent, you will then have 15 minutes. And counsel for appellant, 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. When you begin, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. We do have a time clock up there so you can see how much time you have. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Tim Lamb, and I represent two of the three heirs in this case, appellants Ron Gregory and Jeff Gregory. This appeal stems from their petition to the district court for removal of their sister Judy Vogel as a personal representative. They filed a petition for a number of reasons, but primarily because of personal representative's obvious animus and hatred toward her brothers. In a quick review of the facts, appellants filed a petition for removal of the PR on May 13, 2021. No notice of the hearing on the petition was issued. Respondent had filed a motion for a partial distribution of the estate on April 20, 2021. The asset was the most valuable asset in the estate, a real estate partnership worth over $20 million, which the decedent had an one-eighth interest. The district court issued a notice of a hearing by remote Zoom on April 20th, 2021 for the May 20th, 2021 hearing.
So if I may stop you there, Mr. Lamb, I just want to dive in a bit to this notice of the hearing issue. I mean, you talk about the district court doing this, but I'm looking at Minnesota Statute 524.1-401, which says if a notice of a hearing on any petition is required, the petitioner shall cause the notice of the hearing. And then it talks about a hearing date and time shall be obtained from the court administrator. You know, it's putting that duty on the parties, not on, and you seem to, in your argument, at least in your brief, say, well, the judge should have done this. The judge didn't provide any notice of hearing, but I read those rules to say that's for the party to do. Can you help me understand the interplay between that notice statute and the petition for removal statute?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. The hearing that was conducted on May 20th was just days after we filed the petition for removal. And at that hearing, there was some confusion, if you will, regarding the hearing for the petition for removal. And we were under the impression that the court had set aside a date in July to conduct a hearing for, and set, in fact, a date and time was set up at that May 20th hearing for what we thought was the removal to hear the facts and have an evidentiary hearing on the petition for removal. That July hearing was canceled. And so there shouldn't be any ambivalence, if you will, on a hearing. And we only had, we were actually trying to coordinate that hearing after May 20th.
But Mr. Lamb, what causes me to think that that hearing was held and those motions were heard on May 20th, And the there are two parts of the what the judge says. The judge talks about, you know, Mr. Lamb, you have a motion to relieve Ms. Vogel as a trustee. Is that still on the table, that motion? And then you address the motion. And then the district judge says, I'm going to quote this, since the motions were made and they've been heard today, and I take that to refer to both the motion for the partial distribution and the motion to remove the trustee, I'll take them under advisement. That gives me 90 days to make a decision on these. And why wouldn't we read that and say, that hearing, your motion to remove was heard on May 20th?
Well, I think even the respondent at the beginning of that hearing, Your Honor, acknowledged that the hearing was set up for the partial distribution. In fact, respondent said regarding the motion for removal, and I quote, I want to note that it was filed just a couple days ago and it's not on today's calendar. So I haven't had a chance to respond. In other words, as of May 20th, the respondent did not formally object to the petition for removal.
Wasn't at that point some time given to respondent's counsel to respond, which later happened?
Which later, Your Honor, in August, prior to the other hearing.
Right.
But it was rather confusing for us to say, well, was there a hearing or wasn't there a hearing? And there shouldn't be any confusion in these matters. What we're saying is that there was confusion and there wasn't a dedicated hearing for this particular serious petition to remove the PR. And I know this is rather unique for Minnesota, but in North Dakota, where I practice, and most of the other states in the Midwest, in this A circuit, if you will, the PR, after a petition is filed, their duties are restricted to only administrative duties. So any actions that the PR had taken after that petition was filed should have been null and void. In other words, there was an extension of that purchase agreement made. And while she was under a motion for removal, and that is, our argument is that that should not have been valid.
It's so, Mr. Lamb, I do have some concerns about kind of, some of the, as you said, the confusion around when this was going to be heard. You know, was it in May? Was it the August hearing? I mean, I think you or your co-counsel say at that hearing that the matter is going to be considered then. But, this is a serious matter, but it comes back to what, wasn't it your obligation to clear this up by requesting by providing the notice and getting the calendar date from the court? I mean, that takes me back to Minnesota statute 524.1.401. And so I'm still back to, wasn't that your job? And couldn't that have, if you met that obligation, cleared up some of these questions for us?
Yeah, well, if you, right at the beginning of 524.3, 611, Your Honor, it says that the court will set a date and time for a hearing once the petition is filed. So I think the statute itself, I understand for normal motions that the party establishes the date and time. But for this particular instance, we're under the impression that the court was establishing, and in fact, if you look at the transcript for that May 20th hearing, the court had set up a date and time for a hearing. And that's what was our impression, that that was going to be the date for the hearing on a removal.
And, so from your perspective, this is really an issue. I just want to make sure I understand your position of statutory interpretation, kind of how we read the 524.3611 statute together with or 524.1.401. Are you saying that, and I'm looking at the 1.401, the notice statute, it does say except for specific notice requirements as otherwise provided. So is it your position that the 611 provision kind of is that exception so that it relieves you of that notice requirement?
That's correct. In fact, under the provision for removal or for a restraining order of the PR, the court has 10 days to have a hearing, and that's in the statute. So in this statute, it says right in the statute, upon filing of the petition, the court shall fix a date or a time and place for the hearing. So that's part of the statute, which I would think has more authority than the administrative statute that you're referring to. So that, if you will, you're right, Your Honor, it would be a statutory interpretation of that rule, whether that mandates the court itself to set the date and time for a hearing, or whether it's up to the petitioner. We were under the impression it was up to the court, as they had done previously on the other motions that were filed. Now, moving on.
On that, I have a question for you, counsel. It seems to me from the transcript from May 20th, everyone knew that this court was going to be issuing a decision shortly on the earlier appeal. Do you agree on that? On page 3, it seems like everyone seems to have agreed on that.
Correct. That was the case that was pending before right. This court, a court of appeals.
And then on June 21st, we issued the non-precedential opinion in that case.
Correct.
So we approved of the we affirmed the district court's approval of the PR's actions with regard to the sale. So I'm concerned as a practical matter, isn't that the law? And the Supreme Court denied the petition for review. Don't we already have a law of the case issue here that's been approved and is final?
Well, that's the respondent's argument, Your Honor, but our argument
why isn't that a right argument? I guess is persuade me that that's not right.
That's not correct, because the PR, if she was replaced, the new PR would look at the facts and the situation. And if that purchase agreement had expired in June, as it was meant to expire, then it's not a valid purchase agreement. So in addition to that, the purchaser breached the purchase agreement by not paying for the rent, which is part of the purchase agreement. In fact, they were cited as trespassing on the land last fall, prior to even paying the rent, and the sheriff had to get involved in that instance. And so our contention here is that purchase agreement is not enforceable, and a new PR would consider what's in the best interest of the estate. The best interest of the estate would be to take the higher offer, which is our client's offer of $1.2 million. And so with a new PR, we understand that this court validated the order to sell the property. We're not objecting to the sale of the property. We're objecting to who it's sold to. And we think it should be sold to the appellants, because the original purchase agreement has been breached. not only once, but several times.
Counsel, you only have about a minute left. I want to turn to an argument that you're making in terms of the removal of the, that there's no cause for removal of the personal representative. And you cite to the NRA Estate of Mickelson case. And you cite to it for the proposition that antagonism and animosity alone is sufficient to remove the personal representative, talking about it in the passive voice, but and then implicitly that antagonism toward appellants is enough to remove a party. But when I read Mickelson, that's not what it said. It highlighted that there was a conflict of interest, but there's also that the personal representative there was not emotionally stable, was disinterested in resolving the conflicts, and unsuitable to continue with the proper administration. So that case seems to stand for a more detailed proposition of there have to be more factors involved rather than just an antagonism or animosity between the parties. Would you agree?
Well, I would agree to some extent, Your Honor, but as a fiduciary, which is one of the highest responsibilities that an agent can have. And so you have to have pure heart and pure thought. And I think in this case, there was animosity that precluded this PR from acting in the best interests of the estate. And so if there is that sort of animosity, I think what this case is saying and the other cases that actually were before preceded that case say, and the other states follow this, rule, is that if there's animosity, if the PR doesn't resign, they should be removed. And because how can they function as a responsible PR if you have some hatred or animosity toward the other heirs? It prohibits you from acting prudently.
Thank you, counsel. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your arguments. And please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Anton Cheskis on behalf of the respondent, Judith Vogel, as personal representative for the estate of Joanne Gregory. Unable to accept the finality of a court order approving the sale of a family farmstead, appellants filed a renewed petition to remove their sister as the personal representative of their mother's estate, with allegations largely raised in the approval of the farmstead sale case. After appellants submitted their renewed petition with supporting affidavit and exhibits, the probate court held a motion hearing, which all interested parties attended through counsel, and ultimately denied the renewed petition for removal. The removal hearing complied with Minnesota Statute Section 524.3-611A. The denial of the renewed petition to remove was not clearly erroneous, and therefore the respondents respectfully request that the appeal be denied in its entirety. So the main issue seems to be whether any hearing was conducted at all on appellant's renewed petition. The renewed petition was, with the supplemental affidavits and the exhibits, was filed on May 13th of 2020, and it did not include a hearing date. So on May 20th, the probate court held a hearing, and it held that hearing for two purposes. The first purpose was to address the personal representative's petition to make a partial distribution of estate assets. And the second reason was to address the appellant's renewed petition to remove the personal representative. And when introducing the renewed petition, Judge Vandalis said, quote, "All right, you have a motion. You have a motion to relieve Ms. Vogel as trustee. We've gone down this road before," end quote. And he later added, quote, "You just want to remove her. Is that still on the table, that motion?" And in responding, appellant's attorney said yes. And he goes on to make an argument, which included, quote, "That motion to remove Ms. Vogel is kind of tied up with all of the everything that's going on here," end quote. So thereafter, Judge Vandalist stated that he's going to take both motions heard at the May 20th hearing under advisement. And in response, respondent's counsel requested that although the petition removed be taken under advisement, that the record be kept open to allow respondents to file a responsive brief, which Judge Vandalis granted that request. So after the responsive brief was filed, the record for that motion was closed and the court issued an order denying removal, which is subject to this appeal. There is absolutely no prejudice to appellants by having that renewed petition heard at the May 20th hearing. At no point during the May 20th hearing did either of appellant's lawyers object to having the arguments heard that day, nor did they object to the judge taking the matter under advisement, nor did they object to the judge leaving the record open for the sole purpose of allowing the personal representative to file a responsive brief. The first time an objection was made to that hearing was this appeal. Now, appellant's counsel did express confusion at the August 16th hearing regarding what motion is being heard that day, but that confusion was not reasonable given that the court took this matter under advisement at the May 20th hearing. So there's simply no argument that's valid that would claim that no hearing occurred on the petition to remove.
Mr. Cheskis, if I may, could you directly address Mr. Lamb's argument, which I think, and I'll summarize here, Mr. Lamb will correct me on rebuttal if I'm wrong, is, look, there wasn't a notice given, and that was the court's duty to give that notice because the court is to fix the time and place for the removal proceeding, and that therefore it fits into the exception under 524.1.401, except for specific notice requirements. And I assume that he, as far as your point about prejudice, he would, looking at his brief, would say, look, if we had noticed, we knew this was the hearing, then we would have called witnesses, we would have done more than have three paragraphs of arguments. So if you could address that contention, I would appreciate it.
Sure, several things to that, Your Honor. Number one, the court did fix the time and place. We had the hearing on May 20th. The statute goes on to say that
There was no notice given. Was there anything sent out by the court that said, I'm going to be hearing the petition for removal as well as the partial distribution motion? Or was it simply on the what you're pointing to is on the transcript that day?
It's on the transcript that day, Your Honor. Just as a point of order, the notice of hearings for Zoom hearings no longer specify the type of motion that's being heard. It is listed as a motion hearing. So the second piece to that, Your Honor, is the statute goes on to say that notice shall be given by the petitioner to the personal representative and all other persons as the court may order. All interested persons were present at the May 20th hearing. And this segues into our next point, which is that they appear to be arguing that an evidentiary hearing is required on a petition to remove the personal representative. There's simply nothing in 524.3-611 or anywhere else in Minnesota law that requires an evidentiary hearing. And they knew that because they filed an accompanying affidavit with exhibits, which would have never been admissible under the rules of evidence if this was set to be an evidentiary hearing. At no point did they request an evidentiary hearing. At no point did they, was an evidentiary hearing even discussed. So the court at the May 20th hearing considered the petition. It considered the affidavit evidence that they provided and the exhibits they provided. They heard arguments from counsel, albeit brief. They took the matter under advisement without objection from anybody. And we cite in our brief numerous Minnesota appellate cases that have addressed removal petition statutes without finding any error in holding only a motion hearing and not an evidentiary hearing. And at least one published opinion, the In Re Estate of Martignasso case, the court actually acted sua sponte without any hearing at all when faced with the petition to remove a PR. And the court cites Rule 61 for the proposition that requiring harmless error be ignored. And even under that analysis, this court would look at that decision. And when I say that decision, I mean the decision to perhaps deviate from the specific requirements of that statute as an abuse of discretion. So I would say that to the extent that this court believes 3-611 was not followed to the letter, we would argue that's harmless error and was not an abuse of discretion of the district court.
So, Mr. Cheskus, if I may, Mr. Lamb argued to us that he thought that they were setting up the petition for removal hearing to be in July, that that was, and there was a lot of discussion in the transcript about it, you know, what's the best date in July for about everyone? Well, if it wasn't to hear the petition for removal, is it clear what that hearing was anticipated to be about?
So, Your Honor, if you look, if the court looks at the transcript on page 13, starting on page 13, the reference to July was a phone conference with the judge. This was never intended to be a hearing. The whole point was that while these motions are under advisement, the Court of Appeals is going to rule on the order approving the sale. And after that, let's all get together. Let's talk about what we can do next with this case and these cases in general. This was never meant to be a hearing. The next hearing on this case was appellants filed another petition, this time to temporarily restrain the PR, which was dismissed, which was denied. And then the appellate court, this court dismissed that petition without a hearing because of procedural reasons. And actually in that dismissal, or I beg your pardon, in a dismissal of the motion to extend the automatic stay, this court referenced Mr. Gregory's argument that, hey, a new PR might not act on this purchase agreement. And this court said specifically that the order approving sale was made to Ms. Vogel as the personal representative. So the new personal representative is going to be confronted with an existing court order approving the sale that has been affirmed by this court and is a final order. So there was no hearing set for July, Your Honor, is the short answer to that question. As to the merits of Judge Vandalist's denial of the renewed petition, the allegations are based entirely on facts resulting from the sale of the farmstead, which again were already addressed in the previous Gregory 1 litigation that this court affirmed. So this case were to be sent back on remand, there is no other decision that the district court could reach other than to deny the removal, because again, all of those allegations have been raised and already addressed by the district court.
Thank you, counsel. Any other questions? I don't see any other questions from my colleagues. So we will turn back to appellant's counsel for rebuttal arguments, and you will have 5 minutes for those. Mr. Lamb, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, just as with respect to the notice, that notice that Mr. Cheska is referring to was put out on April 20th, 2021. The hearing was May 20th. We filed the petition for removal on May 13th. So there's no way that notice could apply to our petition for removal. We're actually, quite frankly, caught off guard by the court's bringing up the motion for removal at the time when there was a hearing for the partial distribution that the respondent actually filed. So there was no way that we were prepared to argue. In fact, respondent was not prepared to argue. Respondent did not object to the petition at that time. It was really our understanding that what else would be talked about for another hearing but for the removal. We couldn't really understand why you'd be having another setting up a hearing for any other purpose. Because at that time, that was the only motion that, in fact, that and the distribution motion that was left in this matter. As far as the sale, it's not just the sale, it's also the mismanagement of this estate. My clients, the appellants, have not been apprised of any of the actions that the PR has taken. In other words, they do not know what's been going on with this estate. there hasn't been any mediation effort. The mediation is now part of the law, from my understanding, in Minnesota. It's always been part of the law for family law, and it's helped try to settle the cases out of court. And in this case, the last time the parties actually talked with one another was back in 2019, and that didn't result with anything productive. But a mediator with impartial, being neutral and impartial, would assist the parties in trying to resolve the issues at hand. The biggest issue that I can see, it just seems to be reasonable here. Now that we know that the other piece in this estate is going to be sold, which is the partnership of property, 200 acres off Shakopee, and with that happening, the appellants are going to have more than enough cash in hand to be able to pay the estate, if you will, for the farmstead. I think that's been kind of a problem with negotiating a settlement. The problem has been the PR has listed that asset with a zero value in the inventory, which triggers the district court to say, well, there's no value for that partnership, which consists of 200 acres of prime real estate development land adjacent to Shakopee. It doesn't make any sense. And I think, and it's our contention, the reason that was listed for zero value is that it then takes away the option to settle or to swap that interest with the farmstead, which my clients have been living.
Counsel, didn't this court already address the issue of, it seems to be that you're going to the issue of whether that property should be sold to the brothers. And we already addressed that issue in the prior litigation, didn't we?
Right. What we addressed the prior litigation, Your Honor, was whether the property should be sold. We agree the property should be sold, but that particular purchase agreement that this court approved affirmed the district court is has expired So in the we contend that the PR did not have authority under six or 524.3 to extend it.
And but when I look at the prior case, there is a specific objection to the sale and argument that there's a preference to have heirs purchase the property. And we very clearly differentiated the In Re Estate of Riggle case on that point and said, no, there's no Minnesota case law that says heirs have a right absent an agreement of that. And here there's nothing, there's no agreement that says the heirs have right of first option, for example. So right. Because of that, we affirmed the personal representative being able to sell farm said that they did not have to sell to appellants and they did not have a preferential right to it because there is no specific language in the will or any order from a court.
Correct. But under this appeal, we're asking this court to reverse or remand the district court's order for removal. But on the purchase itself, if the agreement is invalid, Then we got to look at what's in the best interest of the estate. And the best interest of the estate is to take the higher offer, which is $1.2 million that my clients have offered. It's higher than the previous offer.
But to Judge Rodenberg's point earlier, it seems to be the law of the case that we already told the PR that the PR could move forward with a sale of that property.
Correct. But there wasn't they can move forward with the sale. There's no reason why they can't, the PR, a new PR, couldn't move forward with a new buyer who has offered a greater amount than the other buyer who has defaulted and breached the previous agreement. So the new PR has that authority to whom he wants to sell the property to. And if there's a better value for the best interest of the estate, our argument is that better value should be honored. And the PR has that authority. The new PR that we're looking at, both sides have agreed to, and it's a fiduciary. They do it for, that's part of their business. And so with that being said, Your Honor, we asked the court to remand and reverse the district court.
I think Judge Rodberg might have had another
question. I was going to ask a question, but then I think counsel adequately in that last little portion, at least in significant part, responded to what I would have asked.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both for your oral arguments. That concludes the oral arguments for this case. It was well argued and briefed as well. We appreciate that. We'll be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. That concludes our oral arguments for this calendar, and the court is now in recess for its non-oral calendar.